Chris, you better come near your volumes.
Well, I don't want to keep you from your dinner, so let me... For Mr. Kumar's conference, I wrote out a paper very carefully, word by word, and it was too long to read, so I had to do it from notes anyway. So this time I'm just going to go from notes and see where we go. Well, Astra and I have at least three things in common. We both studied together in Paris. We both had one figure in common in our theses, doctoral theses. I did one on Husserl and Bergson. She did one on Bergson and Aurobindo. That's the first time I ever heard the name of Aurobindo in connection with our thesis. And we both lived through the student revolution of 1968 in France. Well, all right, we didn't throw bombs, but we did throw paving stones. So there we are. Now, let me get into my paper. I've chosen, when she asked me to write, she gave me the theme of mutation. I read her book, Presence of Time, which I much admired. So I knew direction her thinking was taking. And I wrote back saying, I think this sounds like self-transformation to me. And she said, oh yes, that's self-transformation. So I started thinking along those lines. Is there a difference between self-transformation and mutation? If so, what is it? And how do I define self-transformation in terms of my philosophy? And do we have time for self-transformation? I don't think we do, which means we need desperately badly mutation, though I can't be convinced, I'm not convinced that that is what we're going to be fortunate enough to get. Anyway, let's get started. In a way, luckily, I came to Aurobindo rather late in my life, because if I'd come too early, I might have been absorbed in his thinking and never bothered to develop my own. He developed his line of thought out of the Vedanta. I came from a completely different standpoint. Basically, I revolted against analytic philosophy with its scientific, in quotes, methodology, gravitated towards phenomenology, which I've never left, worked out my own position in the phenomenological tradition, and only in the middle of that working out of my position did I come across Sri Aurobindo and found that by appropriate modifications I could realign my philosophy in a way which took it in the direction that Sri Aurobindo was already taking. Now, I'll try and avoid technicalities and keep things simple. The method I adopt in Being and Becoming, it's the title of my book, pretentiously, my colleagues hate me for this, I call it Being and Becoming, and think of it as a successor to Being and Time, regarded as one of the monuments of German philosophy, Being and Nothingness, regarded as one of the monuments of French philosophy, and so on. So I call mine Being and Becoming. And the method I've adopted there, I call genetic. Now, if you know anything about Hegel, who developed a method called dialectics, I call mine poor man's dialectics. I'm not clever enough to be a dialectician. So I'm a genetician in my sense of the word, which is mostly borrowed from Piaget. Piaget invented practically child psychology by developing what he called genetic epistemology. What is that? Stage by stage presentation of growth and development, in my case of human consciousness in its entirety, in his case of the child basically from zero till maturity, which for him was formal thought. To me, formal thought is not the end of the process, but for him it was. And that's one of my criticisms. Now, one of my basic premises is taken from Heidegger. I'm going to bother you with the Heideggerian words, the German words, because they put it so beautifully. In English it says, the more consciousness, the less being. And if you know anything about Heidegger, know that the being relation was absolutely paramount in his thinking from the beginning to the end. And in German it goes, je mehr Bewusstsein, doch desto weniger Sein. And the nice thing is that Sein and Bewusstsein are connected in that way. The Germans say consciousness as conscious being. They say being and they say conscious being. So it's put together. What does this mean? We pay for the development of consciousness by the loss of our being relation. That's the price we have to pay. And then the question arises, well, how can we overcome this dilemma or predicament, the resultant dilemma or predicament? Well, I'll show you how I've done it. Heidegger talks and talks and talks and talks about this, and of course, Sri Aurobindo has his solution, which is the supramental descent. I have my solution, which is my fourth stage, but in order to give you my solution, I need to tell you about the three other stages. So I do things in terms of three basic stages in what might look like a linear genesis, step one, step two, step three. You may remember Hegel had his in itself, for itself, in and for itself. That was his three stages, and so mine are sort of equivalent. The first stage is called the originary, where it all starts. Child psychology helps me, anthropology helps me, mythology helps me, psychoanalysis helps me to illustrate out of the humanities what I mean by that. The objective stage is where I situate science and technology and common sense. Okay? Then comes what I call the reflective stage. It's a little bit difficult for me, for people who are not philosophers, for me to tell you what I mean by that. Intuitively, you'll understand. But it's illustrated by transcendental philosophy. Not many of you may know much about Husserl. If you do, that'll be very easy. To me, Husserl was the greatest reflective philosopher that the world has ever known. He pushed the procedure of reflection, which is normally thought to be a philosophical procedure, to its very limit. You can't go further. At least, I don't know how you'd go further than Husserl in that respect. But there was another great philosopher who you probably have heard of. I don't know whether you've studied him. I wrote a book on Kant. An enormous admirer of Kant, and those of you who have even a minimum acquaintance with Kant will know that he distinguished a so-called transcendental, higher transcendental consciousness from a lower empirical consciousness. Aligning these things with my stages, I'd say the empirical consciousness belongs on the stage of the objective stage, which I call the doctrine of mind, and transcendental consciousness belongs on the reflective stage, illustrated by his transcendental philosophy. Now, what we've got is a three-step genesis bringing with it intensification of consciousness, individualization of the self, the child, is not really its own self. It's almost the unconscious hasn't yet developed consciousness of itself and so on and so forth. Intensification, individualization, this might seem initially like a contradiction because along with individualization on the reflective plane, not on the objective plane so much, but on the reflective plane, I see universalization. The self learns to understand that it is not the only self, ceases to be egoistic, learns to see every self as a self in its own right. You could perhaps say this in terms of egolessness. The ego, which is reinforced at the objective stage with all the consequences we're familiar with, becomes or learns to suppress itself and become egoless or to see egos in every self and so on and so forth. Now, so those are the three stages in what might look like. And if I was doing things in a Piagetian sense, I would say, well, that's the end. We get to the top stage, which is not the middle stage as it would be with Piaget, but the reflective stage. The trouble is, if you take Heidegger seriously, this principle of loss of being relation, we've lost contact with ourselves and with the world in a movement of withdrawal to which we owe this increase in, or intensification of consciousness. What are we going to do now? We're sort of hanging up there in the sky, abstracted from ourselves and from the world, which is precisely why, in my view, the linear genesis, step one, step two, step three, has to be converted into a cyclical genesis, a phrase I use to rather nicely sum that up. Remember, my book is called Being and Becoming. Becoming brings being back to its own beginning again. We keep on going around and coming back to our own beginning again. Now, that's the cyclical pattern. I prefer to the cyclical pattern a spiral. We keep going around, but each time we go around, we're also going up. So I think the proper metaphor is the spiral rather than the circle. Nietzsche and eternal return, except I'm not too impressed by Nietzsche's theory. Everyone writes and writes and writes about eternal return. If it's the identically self-same, I don't see what good it is. Identically same person, identically same circumstances, which Nietzsche tells us his theory of eternal return, I see no value. But if we're learning each time, if you interpret it as reincarnation, learning each time, then it begins to mean something. Here's another phrase from a man you may have heard of, to my view, a greater philosopher than Sartre, and perhaps the greatest philosopher, French philosopher of the 20th century was Bergson, which is why Astor and I did our thesis on him. The second greatest, I think, was Merleau-Ponty, and his great theme is embodiment, which brings embodiment back into the ontological frame. And he has a phrase which beautifully summarizes what he thought philosophy was: reflection, upon the unreflected. That says my need for a fourth stage very clearly and simply. You get reflection at the third highest stage by abstracting from self and from the world, but that is only the purpose of gaining reflection or reflective empowerment is to reflect upon what is unreflected, the origin. So the final stage is the return to the first, I call it the reflective recuperation of the first stage. And also, I'm not probably going to be able to tell you how I assimilated Sri Aurobindo's theory of supramental descent as an element of this return to the origin, but you can kind of see it, even if I don't have time to talk about it very much. Now, let's see where. Oh, we're halfway.
There's plenty of time.
Yes, okay. I don't want to keep you from your lunch.
Considering you're on a spiral going up.
Oh, yes. All right. And don't forget that hunger increases your lifespan. So there we are. This is what worries me. It doesn't really worry me because Anand Kumar has told us even if we make the earth unlivable for beings constituted such as ourselves, we will give rise to other beings who live on nuclear radiation and things of that nature. But still, it's a predicament or a dilemma, as I said. First of all, let me define self-transformation and mutation, and you'll see how the problem arises. I just gave them two summary definitions. Here they are. Definition of self-transformation: the result of individual work done on the self by each self separately and individually. It's the sort of work that my work, my project encourages, and it's obviously the sort of work that Sri Aurobindo writes about, each self separately and individually. Definition of mutation, Asta may not agree with these definitions, but still, the result of a collective transformation of the species, for which a theoretical justification might be found, looking for them, Jung's collective unconscious, or Chardin's, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin impresses me much, his new sphere. Now, self-transformation, as far as I'm concerned, I think Sri Aurobindo would agree, takes a long time. It takes a whole lifetime in each individual, separately and individually. We need all individuals, separately and individually, to undergo this process. Do we have time? If we don't have time, Asta has a solution for us, and that is mutation. This is going to happen in spite of ourselves by some kind of process I don't fully comprehend, and I hope that that is the case. But I'm not altogether sure about that because of the three P's, population, pollution, and politics. I won't go into this anymore. You all know what I mean. I have a little paragraph on the extraordinary acceleration of the human population over the last few hundred years. I won't even bother to read it. Pollution, politics, wars, and so on and so forth. And I'm afraid the lessons of history don't strike me as terribly encouraging. Human beings, when they get too numerous, start getting aggressive and looking to expand into neighboring territories, wars, and so on and so forth. the older I get, the more I read history with completely new eyes. I went up to Oxford to study history, and it was the battle of this, so many people did, the battle of that, so many people just wrote it down, mugged it up, reproduced it in your exams. And it took me a long time to realize these are people being killed, these are other people are suffering from their losses. Oh, anyway, I become more conscious of that as time goes by. Elements of a solution. Here are the elements I see in the self-transformative process, which are mildly collective, because obviously mutation is going to be a collective process, both in my thinking, the thinking of Sri Aurobindo, and I think we're not alone, there are a lot of people thinking along these lines. Self-conscious heights and subconscious depths connect. It is one of the fundamental principles of my philosophy that heights and depths connect. And I'm amazed that more philosophers hadn't seen this, because they would have understood that over and over again, the philosophers of depths have succeeded the philosophers of heights, even though depths is where it all begins. So you'd think you'd start, you'd have the depths first and the heights last. No. Plato comes before Aristotle, Kant comes before Hegel, Hegel comes before Marx, Husserl comes before Heidegger. This can't be an accident, especially since two of those figures were pupils of their predecessor, Aristotle of Plato, Heidegger of Husserl. You can't plumb the depths without at your disposal the resources of the Heights. And I think, I mean, I say it in a different way, but I'm sure Sri Aurobindo and Natalia agree with that. And we both of us, this is where I said the middle of my process of working out my philosophy, I came across Sri Aurobindo and I started assimilating his concepts. And here's a trilogy which I've taken from him and made good use of: involution, evolution, devolution. And I work with them in my way, but I've assimilated them from Aurobindo, and those who know Aurobindo will perhaps understand how he works with them. Because spirit is involved in matter from the very first, spirit is capable evolving out of matter through the stages that we know from Sri Aurobindo, the vital, the mental, and the supramental. In my case, it's the objective, which is the mental, and for me, the supramental would be the reflective. And those beings that reach the high point of human consciousness become capable of opening themselves to something above the human sphere, namely to that absolute, which can then let its energies percolate down into us and permeate through us. The trouble is, I think, by personally, that it's only certain highly gifted individuals who are able to open the channels in this way. But this opening, I think, is a possibility, genuine evolutionary possibility, and that will intensify and speed up the process of self-transformation, because you'll be doing it with the aid of higher powers and not merely with your own powers. So those two things belong in my philosophy, and maybe they can support this notion of mutation. Then there is, of course, integral yoga and education, which is a mutation thing, and perhaps globalization and the decline of the nation state. I'm not sure about those things, but mutation is our best hope for a peaceful solution of the problems we confront. I was going to say the problems we confront. I wanted to say something, I'll probably have a bit of time, about the 20th century. It was supposed to be the high point of human civilization, and that part of the world which regarded itself as the high point of the high point was the one that brought the greatest destruction. That is a terrible thing to think about. One had thought that nations that achieved a certain intellectual and cultural level would not do the kind of things that Europe did, and particularly Europe in the 20th century. And it leads us to wonder what virtue there is in education on the one hand and in science on the other, since it simply puts instruments in the hands of people who will abuse them if they can in the interest of power and so forth. From Anand, however, I've learnt to hope, another hope, that because there is another solution, which is the catastrophe solution, which at least will have one evident result: reduction in the population, starvation, disease, war, and so on and so forth. It's not a very promising outlook, but it will reduce the population. And Anand has also given us reason to think that perhaps it won't be as disastrous as it sounds. Even if we do pollute the world beyond the point at which creatures like ourselves can live in it, we can ourselves mutate through a natural biological process so that we will be different beings capable of coping with this world which we've contaminated. But perhaps the single most important thing is that catastrophes make us think about what I'm doing. And I'm sometimes inclined to think that human being who thinks itself so intelligent, so reflective, and so on and so forth, only learns from its mistakes. It's a terrible reflection on human being. We, in the end, only learn from our mistakes. And you need to go back to Europe to think about this. Europe precipitated this appalling catastrophe, these appalling catastrophes in the 20th century. Two world wars and three civil wars, and sometimes the civil wars were worse than the world wars. It is unthinkable today that any European state would wage war on another European state. I mean, terrible way to learn that lesson, but it has. I mean, I'm in Europe now, and I'm working on committees for Franco-German relations and things like this. It's quite clear now that it's unthinkable. But, you know, we had to go through an awful lot before we got there, and maybe other parts of the world will also have to go through an awful lot before they get there. And what will the world be like when we've finished all that? So it will reduce the population. It will, and but I think more we may learn to overcome the obstacles to life that these the pollution of our earth will represent. But I think most importantly, it will give us grounds for thought. It will make us think about our behavior, and then the potential in us will perhaps realize itself. I mean, in the long run, I'm totally optimistic. And I don't think the species is going to ever wipe itself out. We're not going to do that. We may reduce ourselves considerably, but we're not going to wipe ourselves out. In the long run, there's a logic which will lead us. And I think the last paper brought that out very clearly. Science, even if its products destroy us, it's a mental process that produced the products, and it has increased the power of the mind, and it must also increase the power of the mind to consider the dilemmas that its own products produce. So, the thought that whatever else happens, even if we make bad mistakes, we will learn from our mistakes is a sort of positive factor. But there's no question in my mind, I do hope, I'm not sure that Astra is right, I do hope she is, because that is our best solution. But even if the worst scenario happens, I think we'll survive it one way or another. Right, so, I'm not keeping you from your lunch. Yeah.
Thank you, Chris. Beginning from the morning with Anu's reading of a poem, Presence, Premaji's, Anandbhai's, Meenu's, Chris, it's like a spiraling order of optimism and hope. And beginning from life upwards, it's very interesting the sequence it has followed, which I don't know where it was ordained from, Chris, because it has just happened. And I was particularly happy from a European philosopher, putting Jung and all that's happened afterwards in psychology in brackets, to talk about the depths and the heights with that kind of correlativeness, which does not normally exist in Western philosophy, if I may say so. And on a personal note, Chris, it must be after decades that I've heard you speak at length, apart from a personal conversation about your ideas, how they've grown. And it's interesting, Alan, I just see him now. I spoke to him, Chris, about your coming. Alan over there, who edits Orwell Today, and whom I hope you'll meet over lunch, perhaps. That over these decades that we first met in Sorbonne and talked to Shobindu and Bergson and other philosophers and of the European continent, our destinies have led us on similar tracks. And today, in our Orwell meet, where Alan was not here then, his latest monumental life's work, Being and Becoming, in the wake of being and time, being and nothingness. Chris has brought this as a gift to Orwell, considering our new library buildings that are coming up. We have just the right housing for them. Thank you, Chris, and we come back at 2:30. And I have a feeling the spiraling order is going to be carried on in various other dimensions. Thank you. Thanks a lot.